Les colloques du Collège de France.
The next talk is by Lorenzo Fontolan from the InMed and CPT and Turing Center in Marseille. Lorenzo is a computational neuroscientist. He will talk about neural dynamics. He asks the questions, do neural dynamics explain how the brain controls behavior? I hope it does. Does it?
You will see. Well, thanks a lot, Thomas, for the very kind invitation and for this wonderful day so far. I learned a lot. I also had a free introduction by James on dynamical systems that I will talk a lot about, so that was awesome. I will talk a bit about, it's kind of a rhetorical question, but it's not as easy as one may think. So working in Marseille has, it's at the same time a blessing and a curse, because my department is right next to the National Park of Calanque, which is wonderful. So, every morning I have to decide whether I want to, turn left and go to the lab and do some science, or go right and spend a day at the beach. And of course, between the sensory inputs that I get when I bike or go by bus or car, and the action, there is some time and some space, right? And psychologist Viktor Frankl, talking about something rather different, but I like to apply it to this, says that between the stimulus, so the sensory input, and the response, which I call the action, there is a space, which in my case, it's more like time. And in that space or time lies our freedom and power to choose our responses. So of course, as a physicist by training, I try to frame this as a computation. So this transformation going from a sensory input to an action becomes a computation. And what I like to ask, and what we're going to try to do today, is ask, how does the brain generate the transformations that bridge sensation to action? And of course, this involves the brain, right? At least for a lot of organisms. And until not a long time ago, all we could do with the brain was take one cell at a time and painfully record the activity of that cell, as you could see here with a patch clamp technique. So amazingly, in the last few years, we are now able... What's going on? Oh, sorry. Yeah. We're now able to record even thousands of cells now at the same time, either with calcium imaging techniques, so we put mice or other animals under a microscope and record, or with electrodes that can now distinguish the activity of several hundreds of neurons. So now it's getting more exciting, right? We can look at what the brain does across this transformation, these different stages, using many neurons. The problem is that when you have hundreds of neurons simultaneously recorded, it's a bit difficult to understand how to start looking at this. And one thing you can do is, let's say you have three neurons recorded at the same time in at different times. So you can build your neural state space. So now each neuron has its own axis. So R is the activity of that neuron within a certain temporal window. And you can imagine that within these temporal windows, you count the number of spikes, so the activity of that neuron, and you put the point wherever that number of spike is within this space. And so if you move the window to later, now you're here, and then again here towards the end. And if you do it continuously, you have a nice trajectory. It's one-dimensional. It's embedded in a big space, that if the neurons are hundreds, as hundreds of dimensions. But we can try to at least think in terms of this trajectory. So this view of taking a big population and reducing it to a trajectory has been quite successful, at least in terms of characterizing these dynamics and relating them to behavior. For example, for motor reach tasks with primates, Churchill and Chenoy saw that a lot of the neural activity that explained the movement could be essentially projected in a 2D plane, and rotations along this plane can actually tell you a lot about what the monkey will do. Similarly, for navigation tasks in which mice have to go left or right based on cues that that are on the left or the right of this maze, you can again take your neural activity, projected into three dimension, and it tells you, you can decode quite easily whether the mouse at some point will end up going right or left. And even more strikingly, maybe more recent work on the head direction, so you can actually decode the direction of the head of insects or fish, and put that activity on a one-dimensional ring embedded in two dimensions, and that ring will tell you the angle of the head. So that's a quite successful way of at least correlating this activity with the behavior. But first, we don't know if there's any causality, right? And second, we don't really know whether this can point to an actual mechanism. Is this simply a way to visualize, or is this something that can tell us something about how the biology is working underneath? And so when I was at Geneva, I started working with these wonderful people here, in particular Carl Sander was my supervisor, but Carl Arseni and Idehiko were doing experiments in mice, and they had essentially the same experiment that I have every morning when I go to the office. So there was a mouse who had received sensory instructions, and these sensory instructions were related to a later action that the mouse had to implement. And in the middle, there was a delay in which the sensory input was not present. So the simplest possible decision-making task you can imagine. And at the time, before I arrived, a postdoc in the lab had essentially screened the whole cortical surface of the mouse brain by optogenetically silencing that, all of these areas selectively during the delay to essentially find whether there was an area or a region that was necessary for this behavior to be carried out. And luckily, you know, it could have been a very distributed computation, but it turned out that there were only two frontal areas, symmetric, that cared for this. And if you silence via optogenetic, which is essentially a way to turn on and off your neurons, you can get the behavior to go to chance level if you silence these two areas during the entire duration of the delay. So this tells you that these two areas are maybe linked to this transformation that I cited before, that I mentioned before, and these areas are called anterior lateral motor cortex, or M2, they're part of secondary motor cortex that people thought was more related to helping with generating movements, but in reality, we saw that it's more related to making decisions, at least that have to do with orofacial movements. So we can go in that area, and now we can record quite a few neurons, right? If we take one example, so this is one cell, on the y-axis is trials, each dot is a spike, and on the x-axis you have time, so the sample, when the stimulus comes in, the delay, and the response. And you can see that we can divide trials based on whether the mouse ended up leaking to the left or to the right. And this is for correct trials, so trials in which the mouse matched correctly the stimulus to the action and got the reward. And then if you average each trial type, what you get is that this neuron tends to have selectivity and persistent activity. Selectivity because it's able to distinguish between left and right trials. So if you want to decode the future behavior of the mouse based on this neuron early in the delay, you can. And the activity is also, this change is persistent, so it goes on for a few seconds, which is quite a lot longer than the membrane time constant of a single neuron. So one question one can ask is, well, is this a transformation, or is this neuron simply carrying on the information about the sensory stimulus? So it's just a reverberation of that stimulus, or there is something going on? Well, for that, you can look at error trials, so trials in which the mouse, even if it wanted the reward, ended up making a mistake, which happens 15% of the time, 20 sometimes. And you can see that you can actually decode the error early if you look at this neuron. So this means that the neuron cared about the future action and not the stimulus. The stimulus was the right stimulus, but the action was the wrong one. And if you look at this neuron, you will know that the mouse will make a mistake. Okay, so same as before, we have our 30 to 50 neurons, in this case, per session. The state space is too big to be visualized in 3D, like I showed you before. So what we can do is we can do some dimensionality reduction to reduce even more the dimensionality of this 30 to 50 neurons. And if we're able to find this low-dimensional representation, often we refer to this representation as neural manifolds, meaning that the activity tends to sit on this lower dimensional manifold, so planes or hyperplanes that are quite lower in dimension than the full space. In this case, it's a very simple task. We were quite lucky. Basically, with two dimensions, you can capture most of the variability. So these are the two most important modes if you try to apply your dimensionality reduction technique. We call them choice direction and ramping mode. Choice direction because it turns out that the first mode is the mode that maximizes the difference between left and right trials. So it's the maximally decoding manifold. And the ramping mode is the mode that maximizes, that captures the biggest temporal change, so the ramp, that you see actually in 40-50% of cells. So this is quite a big effect. Basically this is what I was saying. So we can now take this coding direction, project for each session the activity onto that mode, and again you see basically that the population activity looks very much like this neuron. Of course, this is lateralized, it's only from one hemisphere. If you take both, it's perfectly symmetric, right? They tend to care a bit more about the movement in one direction than the other. But now we have a simple way to look at this. Of course, you can notice that there is this slow ramp. I'll ask you to put it a bit aside for the moment. We'll focus on the persistency of the activity and not really the slow ramp. So what we did is basically think of different models that can give you this persistence and selectivity that are based on low-dimensional representation. We know that the activity is low-dimensional, so we can almost enumerate the models in a dynamical system space that can give rise to this kind of activity. And we wanted to be able to distinguish them, to select and say, well, this is maybe the way the system works. So one could be, for example, having discrete attractors. James mentioned them, but they're essentially just fixed points of the dynamics. So whenever the stimulus comes in, the activity sits in one of these fixed points and stays there until the action is performed. You can imagine that instead you have some sort of continuous attractor, right, where it's not just two fixed points, but a lot of points that are all stable. So a lower intensity stimulus could also be stable. Or you can imagine that there is some sort of sequential activity where the activity is bounced off by one group of neurons to another. And if they're fine-tuned or they have enough connectivity constraints, you can also find something like that. So how do you distinguish between these models? Well, the only thing you can do is ask your experimental collaborators to make perturbations. So if you make perturbations during the delay, these models give you different predictions. Some, for example, will tell you, in the case of the fixed points, that if you're within your Bayesian, the perturbation may decay back and you're back to the fixed point. For an integrator, instead, a perturbation will be integrated too, if it's along the right manifold. And for sequential activity, it can depend a lot on the details of the system. So what we did was enumerate all these models, and we found out that the discrete attractor picture is the compatible one with what I told you. We can easily model it with a two-dimensional system, essentially, with, I show you three populations, but you can do it with two if they're mutually inhibiting. It's a low-dimensional system. It's finite-rate models, so we don't care about the biophysics of the single neuron. And we look at the mean activity across neural populations. So you have one population that cares for one direction and the other one for the other. And that explains almost everything. Well, there's still the slow ramp to be explained, which at the time nobody had really thought about in terms of these models. So what one can do to achieve a slow ramp is, of course, to tune your manifold so that the activity starts from here, but now the manifold is quite shallow, so the time scale is now slow. You can go to the fixed point, but it takes a few seconds, right? This requires a lot of tuning. So it's one solution, but it's not a very robust one, especially if you want to be flexible in terms of the delay. And so another solution could be that you have an external signal now to that brain area that I showed you, that it's not selective, so it doesn't care about going left or right. It just scales essentially the signal by giving you the ramp at a much slower time scale. So in that case, the activity sits always at a fixed point, but it's the landscape that it's modulated by this signal. So you're always at a fixed point, but the fixed point is getting deeper and more separated. So there's also this slow ramp that we tried to explain with that model, we also tested by taking into account the heterogeneity of the neural activity. So I told you that, you know, we can capture everything with a very low dimensional model, but in reality, if you look at your neurons, they have extremely diverse dynamics, right? In time and in terms of selectivity. So we wanted to make sure that this model could be implemented by the actual network. So what you can do is you take a recurrent neural network, so a network of units that interact with each other with some nonlinearity, and you train them such that each unit corresponds to a neuron that was recorded. In this way, you're basically forcing the network to learn the dynamical system that it's represented by the recorded neurons. And then you check whether when you do the perturbations that the network never saw, the network is able to generalize. So it turns out it did, and that if you now reverse engineer this network, so if you look into this network and try to see whether it's actually low dimensional, it's very low dimensional. So you can, again, retrieve your low dimensional energy landscape. One thing that we noticed that we didn't think when we were looking at the simple dynamical system picture is that with the training, there is essentially the emergence of a bifurcation. So you go from one fixed point at the beginning of the trial to two fixed points during the delay. And the bifurcation parameter is this ramping input that is received by the network. So this was reassuring because essentially the hypothesis we made can be implemented by the actual neurons that were recorded. Just a little side note that I don't have time to show you, but essentially these discrete attractors plus ramping is also responsible for regulating how information flows in during the different phases of the task. And this is due to the fact that the landscape is changing. So early on in the delay, if you introduce new information, this information can change quite a lot the fate of the decision, right? So if you, for example, introduce a distractor, this distractor will be integrated because the barrier between the two fixed points is quite low. Late in the delay, this is not true because the barrier is now quite high. So the same distractor will be rejected by this brain area, which means the mouse is getting more and more committed to making that action that it has selected. So this is if you imagine now a more complex task, this could be a way to do this this gating. Okay. We also can try to relate this ramping signal to something, some computation that the brain may be implementing. And in particular, one thing to note is that what I showed you so far was for mice that always saw the same fixed delay, the same 2 seconds. They were trained, overtrained, they always saw 2 seconds. So clearly they were able to predict these 2 seconds time of the delay. If you now imagine that mice get random delays, so they cannot really get ready for a certain length, they have to get ready for the shortest possible one. If this ramp reflects any kind of temporal signal, or prediction about when to get ready, the activity should change now according to this new ramp. That should be very fast because the mouse doesn't want to miss the short delays in this distribution. So if you train mice to do this, you actually notice now that there's no more slow ramp in the activity. So this is an example from one neuron, and this is the population activity. And you can see that the ramp is much faster, and it happens during the sample. During the delay, there's no ramp. And same at the level of single cell. So essentially, mice are trying to predict what's happening, and this prediction is modulating this landscape very, very clearly. Okay, so just to give you a little summary so far, we saw that discrete attractor dynamics can explain transformation of information from sensory to action, at least in this very simple task. The mechanism that I showed you can also gate information across brain regions, so from more sensory to decision areas, and can provide robustness or flexibility at different times. As a side bonus, we can also say that these slow ramping dynamics that a lot of people saw before and were thought to be linked to the memory, to the presence of the stimulus, are actually not really necessary because in the random delay, the ramp is not there and you have a flat activity during the delay. So it's not related to the memory, but more to the temporal predictions. So we later went to look to try to see, well, where is this signal now coming from? So we know that it's not from cortex because our modeling tells so. So maybe it's subcortical. And this is also based on the fact that earlier I showed you that cortical optogenetic inactivations that didn't have any effect. So maybe it's in some subcortical region. We focus on the basal ganglia, which is a region that has already been linked to temporal signals. There are several pathways in the basal ganglia that could be considered. We essentially focus on this D1, this direct pathway. These are all inhibitory neurons. So what I'm showing you is actually a functional circuit. If you want to actually make the ramp, you have to consider a more complex circuit. But what we could find is basically that if you now have a task that it's slightly different, so you don't now ask the mouse to lick left or right, you just ask the mouse to lick at a certain time. It just has to lick in front of them and get the reward if it waits for a sufficient time. So to simplify even more the task, and then with my collaborators, Ideiko, who is now at Max Planck Florida, he could record activity from these two regions simultaneously. The first thing you notice is that if you just look at the activity, and the color code here is the duration of the delay, they're basically indistinguishable. So if you take a random neuron from striatum or cortex, you wouldn't know where it's from if you don't know in the first place. So that's not enough to say something about the role of basal ganglia. And again, we turn to modeling with dynamical systems, and we ask the question, well, if we imagine that each of these two areas are two recurrent neural networks that are connected to each other, which one is able to produce the ramp, or do you need both to produce the ramp? And again, we turn to perturbation. That's how you settle these debates. So we consider different hypotheses, one in which the integration, the ramp, is produced through the interactions, one in which each area may be responsible independently for producing the ramp, even if we don't think the cortex is doing it, one in which the striatum is the source, and one in which maybe there's some third area that we didn't consider that is actually responsible. So if we look at these simultaneous recordings during perturbations, and this is the case in which we're perturbing the cortex, so top is recordings in cortex when perturbing cortex, bottom is perturbing cortex but recordings in striatum. And again, it's the same color code, so red means longer delays, blue shorter. What you see is essentially that during the perturbation, any information is gone. All the information is gone from cortex. You cannot distinguish the delays. But this information is still there in the striatum. So if one essentially tries to decode the licking time, so when the mouse will actually lick based on the activity in the striatum, what you see is that the licking time is kind of increasing linearly, and then at the moment of the perturbation, it kind of goes back to what it was before the trial even started. And then whenever the perturbation is released, the activity, so this lick time prediction, restarts from where it was. So it's like a freezing of the computation. And then it just goes up. So you're basically just delaying the lick by a fixed amount if you inactivate cortex. So this is like a stopping of the timer. If you do the same, so if we now look at the activity in both areas when we're now inhibiting the striatum, what you see is that information is present still a little bit in both areas, actually quite a bit in the striatum, but that now the prediction of the leak is actually has a leak, meaning that during the perturbation, you're losing some time. So you're delaying your lick time by more than just the rigid shift, you have a leak of time. So you're sort of rewinding the timer, right? Like in the old VHS, which makes us think that it's the striatum that is producing the ramp, and when we're inhibiting it, we're damaging this process. So this was our conceptualization. The striatum is generating the ramp. The ALM is receiving it. But we know that there is reciprocal connections, and we don't know yet how is the information getting to the striatum. So what we can do is now look for whether the information about the duration of the delay is present in either area before the trial starts. So how does the striatum know how to produce this delay? It must save this information somewhere. Turns out that it's not in the striatum. It's in the cortex. So if you look at cortex at ALM, you can read out the identity of the delay in the intertrial interval. But you cannot if you look at the striatum, which means essentially that the striatum is producing the ramp, but to do it is using a tonic signal from cortex. And then in turns, this ramp moves the attractors that are also in cortex, which, you know, as a computational, as a modeler, this was very, very fun to do because it's a distributed network, quite simple. You need the whole network to produce your dynamics, but each area has its own role. So we also have, you know, some theory about learning, about how this comes into play that I don't really have time to talk about. I just want to mention that it works. So it basically, this little network that we set up learns exactly like the mouse and produces the slow ramp. So you can have the dynamical system learned just by simple correlation with the behavior. Okay, so far so good. The question I asked you at the beginning seems, the answer seems to be yes. But is this the whole story? Well, at some point I went back to the recurrent neural network that I trained on the data. And in the super simple picture, the prediction would be that if you take a neuron, a unit, that is selective for one direction, let's say from lick left, so this one, and look at the connectivity, the postsynaptic connectivity. So what's the selectivity of the neurons that neuron is connected to? In the super simple picture, they should be connected only to similar selective neurons, and they should inhibit the other type of neuron, right? That's the super simple picture within this model. So if you look at the actual connectivity of the network that was trained on the data, you do find a lot of neurons. So each dot here is a neuron that is mostly connected to neurons of its kind. And this for the other side. But you also have a lot of neurons that are connected to the wrong side, which is not what you predict from the simple system. So I started thinking, well, this maybe is interesting. And because we have these networks, we can make experiments. So we can stimulate random groups of neurons. And we know the selectivity, so we can know to which neurons they were connected to and what was the general pattern. And so if you stimulate these guys or these guys here, you expect to get essentially a reinforcement of the decision that the mouse already took. So if you stimulate red, you get more red behavior. That's not the case if you stimulate these guys. So you think you're stimulating a neuron that should bring you to the left, but you get trials where the mouse gets it wrong and goes to the right because of the stimulation. So this is not very robust, right? This is not what you would want. So the true one is actually this one. So at the time, with Kavon, who's now at the Allen Institute, Kavon was developing an holographic stimulation system where you have your mouse on a microscope with calcium imaging, and you can stimulate small groups of neurons exactly like in the RNN, 8 to 10, depending on connectivity and selectivity. And what he saw is that, on average, if he was stimulating neurons that were selective for one direction or the other, he would get zero behavioral effect, which is weird, right? You know those neurons, you can decode the activity from the neurons, you're stimulating them, but nothing happens. It turns out that it's because we were binning the data in the wrong way. So we were binning them based on the selectivity of the stimulated neurons. But if you bin them instead on the behavioral change, meaning that in some sessions there was some behavioral change, meaning that the mouse was getting more trials wrong on one side, and then post hoc check the selectivity of the neurons that were stimulated, you actually see that it's always the same group of neurons that it's causing behavioral changes in both directions, right? So you're getting blue neurons that stimulate blue neurons, maybe here, and blue neurons that stimulate red neurons here, which is, again, against this low-dimensional model that I presented. So something was brewing. So what we thought of doing is, well, let's try to see whether this selectivity, this decoding, maybe it's not the whole story. Maybe we need to go beyond. So what we did was check at different times whether we could find the mode, so your vector of neurons in the neural state space, that could predict the projection at the end of the trial along the choice mode. So in other words, what is the best vector of neurons you can take at some time in order to predict whether the mouse will go left or right? Not at the time of the decision, but earlier. And it turns out, well, this is how we did it, which is not super interesting, but it turns out that, ID and TD are exactly the same. We changed the name. So wherever you see TD, it's these modes here that I mentioned. So it turns out first that, yes, you can find these modes, and these modes are not the choice direction. So they're completely different. Much higher dimensional system now. And that these modes carry very little selectivity. So if you would try to decode the behavior of the mouse looking at these modes, you wouldn't really consider them. But they have a much bigger influence on the future projection than the mode itself that gives you the decision. And these different modes that we find at different times, this is the one during the stimulus, then we basically tile the whole time, they are almost orthogonal to each other. So they're not one mode that is, fluctuating a bit because of noise. They are 75 to 80 degrees apart. So this points to a weird dilemma where you have locally fixed points, but these fixed points are causally determined by other modes that are not within the same dimension. And then if you look at the selectivity of these modes, this is the white one is the early mode, and the black is the latest mode, which is the CD. You can see that the selectivity of the CD is obviously very high. It's basically just the difference between these two. The selectivity of the early modes is very low, or it even just decays to zero. That's why we missed them when we were looking at ways to decode or compute principal components. They're not modes that explain a lot in terms of selectivity. So we went back to the experiment and we checked whether the selectivity along the CD would cause behavioral differences, and it didn't. So you're stimulating the mode that carries the biggest decodability, but you're not getting a behavioral difference. If by chance, because we didn't know at the time, you stimulated the early mode, then you did get quite a big difference. And again, these are very small modes, so it's a bunch of neurons that are a little bit active, but nobody cares about, usually. This is just to summarize that the early modes tend to have a much bigger correlation with behavior than late modes. So now the model needs to change. We need to include a lot more dimensions that change in time. So one trivial way to do it is to now have some sort of chain where each mode is connected to the other modes in a feed-forward way. So the activity just bounces from one mode to the next. You need to fine-tune it a bit because you also want the selectivity to be amplified, which is not great. This model that we put in the paper is basically based on non-normal dynamics, which is a concept that it's well known, but some people in neuroscience have started exploring in recent years, where essentially you have a non-normal part of your connectivity matrix W that can be understood in terms of feed-forward connectivity. So essentially, you get some amplification and some dynamics just by the fact that you're switching from one mode to the other, but they're not fixed points, essentially. They're transient dynamics. But again, this needs a lot of fine-tuning. The model is able to capture this difference between selectivity and behavioral influence. And this, again, I just want to mention, this is really something you would miss with classical neurodynamics. So that's why the question becomes a bit more interesting that I asked in the beginning. Can neurodynamics explain behavior? Yes, but you have to rethink the way you look at neurodynamics. So just to summarize this part, targeted optogenetic perturbations showed us that these modes that carry little variance and selectivity, the big modes that carry a lot of variance and selectivity are not causally relevant for behavior, and that we need new models that combine low dimensional local activity with some high-dimensional evolution of the activity in time, right? Which is not trivial. One other way to do it, and then I will conclude, that doesn't go through this very fine-tuned non-normal dynamics would be to now think of your local two fixed points and then imagine that they're rotating in time, and by rotating, they will span a much bigger space. Of course, you have to again make sure that there are constraints that you have to take into account. One way to try to put the constraints in is to go back to the RNN, and now instead of training the RNN on the data, you train the RNN on reproducing essentially some high-dimensional helix. So you can train the RNN essentially to give you a latent dynamics in low dimension, and this. This is possible, so this is what we can do. You can then try to decode the trajectory along the fixed point once you've trained, and it works perfectly. This is actually a real simulation. And you can make experiments. You can, again, perturb on this network, and you can look at the effect of perturbations on your helix. And what you see is that it's a bit messy here because this is very preliminary, but essentially perturbations in different directions, they all fall back onto the helix. So the helix is attracting. And now you can imagine that this rotation of these ID or TD modes is basically just a different position on this helix. And you're taking snapshots, but it's at different angles. And that's why you get this high dimensional activity. So to conclude, I hope I convinced you that cortical circuits exhibit, in certain situations, stable low dimensional activity patterns, right? That enable the brain to hold stimuli in memory and transform them into actions. That this activity is organized in fixed points, in attractors, and the attractors are modulated by temporal expectations. And generating this dynamics is actually a distributed process that involves several areas that have different tasks. And at last, that our classic view of neural dynamics, we need to update it because we're missing the most important part of this question, which is what causes behavior. You can decode, but it doesn't mean that you can understand whether the behavior is generated by that dynamics or not. And so we need new models like the two I showed you. There are other models brewing. It's a moment where people are getting excited by this because it's rather new. And so if you have ideas, well, let's talk in front of a beer. I'm sorry. These are the people who did the experiments, so many thanks to them.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.